I'm down here for several reasons this morning. One, I feel just by gifts and personality that I'm a little bit more of a moderator or a facilitator than I am a lecturer. And that's not bad. It's not necessarily good. It's just who I am personally. Secondly, you may notice my voice is about an octave lower than it normally is. Rita may physically be down around Louisiana, Texas Gulf Coast, but trust me, she's in my sinuses right now. And so if you can help me out this morning and help us out mutually. I am not the only one in here who has ever studied or been a part of dispensationalism. In fact, I probably should have asked Ken Poles to bring his old charts with him. If you ever get a chance to see those, do so. He's the only guy I know of who in his dispensational days had more precise charts than Clarence Larkin did. Fantastic. Let me use that as an introduction and to get to know you as well. How many of you at some point in your past were raised in or formally taught the system known as dispensationalism? Okay, that's what I figured. Vast majority of us. How many of you were not raised in it, but you have and never were an adherent of it, but you've at least done some study in the system? Okay, another 3, 4, 5, or 6. How many of you have very little idea of what we're talking about when we say dispensationalism? And that's okay, yeah. That always amazes me. Not that there are any, but that there are so few. Because it seems to me that the system has been so dominant in evangelicalism that I almost expect when I say, how many of you know dispensationalism, for everybody to raise their hands. Usually, it's the younger ones, by the way, who are unfamiliar with it. And that says something about dispensationalism, that it is going away, at least in its classical form, in its Schofield, Lewis Berry Chafer, Charles Ryrie, if you will, type of dispensationalism. It seems to be on the wane. In fact, even at Dallas Seminary, the founding place, if you will, in many respects of evangelical dispensationalism, it's rare to find a professor there or a student who holds to the original scheme of the seven dispensationalism. So let's talk about that a little bit this morning. And the first question is, why even talk about it at all? If it's going away, and even its original place of adherence is somewhat turning against it, why even talk about dispensationalism at all? Well, we as Calvinists love to blame every problem in modern-day religion on Arminianism. And after a while, that gets old. So what we're here to do today is to give you someone else to blame for all the problems in modern-day religion. No, that's not quite it. But I think if we have a good understanding of dispensationalism, we will see some of its effects in religion. Every theology has its results. Every idea creates consequences. You cannot believe something and not have it turn into practice somewhere along the line. And so it is with dispensationalism as well. So we're going to talk a little bit about its history, its major ideas, and then its implications as well. If something I say spurs a question in your mind or a thought in your mind, please, by all means, contribute. You guys know this system probably as well as I do. You are pastors. You think biblically, and we're all Calvinists here. At least I think we are, or at least interested in the concepts of dispensationalism and covenant theology. So we can teach each other. You can teach me as well as I can you this morning. Don't be afraid to raise your hand and contribute it one way or another. If you don't, I will find a way to make you do so before it's all over. All right? So you might as well go willingly. History of dispensationalism. And let's start with John Nelson Darby, born 1800 and died in 1882. Just a little bit, first of all, of his early history, the Plymouth Brethren, and then some of his ideas. He was the son of a wealthy parents. But he decided to enter the ministry of the Church of England at an early age, and when he did, his father disowned him, cut him off from all inheritance. About 1830, in the ministry with the Church of England, he decided that there was no such thing as apostolic succession. And of course, in the Anglo, or perhaps Anglo-Catholic realm, apostolic succession is somewhat of an important idea, and certainly in the Church of Rome. And so he turned away from this idea. He espoused the idea that there was, in fact, no such thing as clergy or pastors or elders, that all people were capable of preaching and all people should preach, men and women alike, as God and the Spirit gave them the desire to do so. So that their meetings of the Plymouth Brethren became somewhat like perhaps Quaker meetings, if you're familiar with them. Instead of an organized preaching in an organized setting, there would just be a gathering. There would be some prayer, some songs of thanksgiving, some mutual exhortation, each person speaking out perhaps as they were led of the Spirit to do so. He said the recovery of the true church was necessary. That the whole church had become apostate. Every denomination was filled with error. There was no true church anywhere in the world. And he, of course, set out to recover the true church. And then the last, as you might imagine, of his major ideas, is that the second coming was very near. Darby's ideas caused a lot of stir in England, so much so that he was attacked on all sides, in print, in sermons, newspaper, everywhere you can imagine. And he actually removed from England for a time and went to Lausanne, Switzerland. And it was here that his particular preaching on the fact that the second coming was near really began to take root, and where his movement really began to gain some strength before making his way back to England later on. Spurgeon. I don't want you to read that quote just yet. John Nelson Darby died 1882. Okay. Well, Charles Spurgeon was alive, right, in England. And I thought, let's just kind of do some search and see what Spurgeon thought about the Plymouth Brethren and the Darbyites. All right? And I've got an extended quote. It's actually going to cover three screens, but it's a very good quote. And what Spurgeon is doing here, and this is from his Sword and Trowel. What Spurgeon is doing is he's reviewing a pamphlet written by a gentleman, and he's encouraging this gentleman to put the pamphlet into a full booklet form. And the pamphlet, of course, is on the topic of the Plymouth Brethren. So here's Spurgeon's quote. As on all hands, with a diligence never exceeded and a subtlety never equaled, they, talking about the Darbyites, they are laboring to seduce the members of our churches to the subversion of the truth and the overthrow of the needful order and discipline of our Zion. It may be well to disseminate information concerning their sentiments and tactics. And then he tells you why. Because there is nothing which they have so much to dread as being thoroughly exposed. For their grosser errors are not generally made known to their dupes until they are fairly in their meshes. What he's saying is the Plymouth Brethren doesn't tell you, the movement doesn't tell you what they really believe until they've got you kind of pulled in. And he's saying they were using methods of secrecy and of sensationalism to draw members in, and then to eventually teach them what it was they fully believed. Here's the rest of their quote. Mr. Grant, the gentleman that wrote the book, or the pamphlet, has done real service to the churches by his treatise on the heresies of the Plymouth Brethren. Now notice the name of the pamphlet, and Spurgeon says he's done a good job by printing this little pamphlet. The heresies of the Plymouth Brethren, strong language, which we trust he will publish in a separate form. It is almost impossible for even his heavy hand. Mr. Grant was a fighter. Mr. Grant was in his day apparently was one of these guys that just loved to rail against people. And Spurgeon says it's almost impossible for even his heavy hand to press too severely upon this malignant power, whose secret but rapid growth is among the darkest signs of the times. How many of you ever heard that Charles Spurgeon was a dispensationalist? Sword and Trial, Volume 2, January 1869. He refers to it as one of the darkest signs of the times. That's Spurgeon on the Plymouth Brethren. All right, so why even talk about the Plymouth Brethren? Well, there are some relationships then to Mr. Scofield. Scofield Reference Bible is perhaps one of the most influential documents in creating dispensationalism in America. The Brethren movement came to America and produced what was called the Niagara Bible Conferences in the 1870s. And Scofield attended as many as he could. He was heavily influenced by them. And eventually he adopted the viewpoints on eschatology, prophecy, and scripture that the Brethren movement and the Niagara Bible Conferences were giving them. And he worked it through perhaps a little more thoroughly, adapted, changed some things, and then came up with the idea of releasing a reference Bible with notes in it that would give his view or that particular view of dispensationalism. It was originally released in 1909. I think, if I remember correctly, it's not actually until 1917 that the full project is finished, Old and New Testaments alike. So usually if you have a Scofield Reference Bible, it will say, with the original notes of 1917. Scofield then in turn influenced a gentleman by the name of Lewis Berry Chafer. Lewis Berry Chafer at a young age as a young minister and musician, by the way, was a very gifted pianist, capable of leading singing, had a good voice. In 1904, he meets Scofield at the Southland Bible Conference and begins working with Scofield. Scofield is somewhat of a traveling evangelist at this time, going around teaching, and Lewis Berry Chafer becomes his music man. Kind of a George Beverly Shea to Billy Graham kind of a relationship. Later on, Lewis Berry Chafer moves to Dallas, Texas. He pastored a church there that was originally started by Scofield back in 1877, and that church is still there. Scofield Memorial Church, 7730 Abrams Road, I believe is the address in Dallas, Texas. It's still there to this day. They've got a website and everything. Chafer founded the Evangelical Theological College, which is now known as Dallas Theological Seminary, 1924. And in 1948, he wrote his 8-volume systematic theology. How many of you either have that or have referenced it at some point in time? Let me ask you a question. What is your impression of that 8, not the doctrine necessarily, the writing style of it? 8-volume systematic theology. Have you ever found it just maybe a bit tedious? And I'm not trying to be insulting, that there's a reason for what I say. Or how many of you have ever read through that one, Things to Come by J. Dwight Pentecost? And he's got an outline form. For example, one of his chapters is on the character of the millennium. And he's got a major point, Roman numeral 1, the character of the millennium. And his ABCs wind up going to like double W. There's a reason for that. The dispensational movement in America wedded itself to what they called the scientific method of biblical exegesis. Since we've talked about hermeneutics already this week, their perspective was that you could treat interpretation of the Bible the same way you treated exploration of any scientific subject. You gather your data, you list it out, you categorize, you subcategorize, and then from these categorizations and these scientific analogies, you draw your conclusions. It's all reasonable. It's all very logical. It was the idea that science has given us a method by which we can exegete the scriptures. Now, they were not rationalists. They were not liberals in any sense of the word. But they took the scientific method, if you will, of data gathering, hypothesis, categorization, conclusion, and wedded it to an evangelical viewpoint of scriptures to come up with their particular system. Hence, if you have his systematic theology, it's 8 volumes long, and that's the reason for it. They often will list point after point after point after point of observation to finally reach their conclusion in somewhat of a data-gathering scientific manner. All right, this is the somewhat of the history of dispensationalism, the major tenets. First of all, the definition and the outline of dispensations. All right, since we're talking about Scofield dispensationalism just for the moment, how many dispensations are there? Okay, yeah, y'all just say it out loud. 7. Okay, here's the real test, because I have to remember them or take my time. We've got a timeline here. This is the creation of the world back here in eternity past. This is the eternity future out here. Okay? First dispensation was referred to as... Somebody said it. Innocence. Thank you. By the way, this is always just real fun writing, but I think I'm getting the hang of it. Okay, innocence. Innocence was the dispensation of what? Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, right? They were in a state of innocence, right? By the way, let's define a dispensation. A dispensation is a period of time in which man is given a particular test. Man always fails the test. God always brings judgment and then ushers in a new dispensation with a new test. Okay? Let's see if I can give you some quotes that might help you out here on this. This is from Scofield's notes. If you were to look up Genesis 1:28 in Scofield's Bible, a dispensation is a period of time during which man is tested in respect of obedience to some specific revelation of the will of God. 7 such dispensations are distinguished in Scripture. Donald Campbell, in his book, attributed to Walvoord, a dispensation is a time period with a test that always ends in failure. Okay, so Adam and Eve have a test. Okay, test is, don't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Man always fails that test. God always brings judgment. And then you move on to the next dispensation. After that, I'll just go ahead and list them out for you. Dispensation of conscience. Men were tested according to whether they would obey their consciences or not. Man failed, so judgment comes in. After that, the judgment, by the way, here is the flood. The judgment here is the removal from the Garden of Eden. The judgment here is the flood. Now they are supposed to be tested according to whether they will obey the dictates of human government, which God initiates after the flood with Noah. They fail that. The judgment is the Tower of Babel. Okay. And then we have the dispensation of promise through Abraham. Israel fails that. Interestingly enough, they fail it by accepting the Mosaic Law. When they came to Mount Sinai, according to Scofield, God says, okay, here's my laws. Do this and live. And Israel was supposed to say, no, we're under this dispensation of promise. We don't need this law stuff. But Israel instead says, okay, God, if that's what you want, that's what we'll do. And God says, you failed. So now you're no longer under promise. Now you're under law. The failure was the acceptance of the Mosaic Law. You can read that in Scofield. Let's see if I've got that quote for you. No, I don't have it. But you'll find it in Scofield's notes in the Exodus passage, Exodus chapter 19 and 20. In Scofield's notes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here we come finally then to the next dispensation, and that is the dispensation of grace. You'll notice the parentheses. Finally, the seventh and last dispensation is that of the millennium. According to dispensationalists, when Jesus Christ came, His original offer was the kingdom, to bring in the millennial kingdom. Had the Jews repented of their sins and accepted Christ as their king, their Davidic king, He would have brought in the kingdom of heaven on earth, the millennial kingdom, right there on the spot. They did not. They rejected Him. And so, from Matthew 1 through 12, and you can find this in Things to Come, as well as in Schofield's notes. From Matthew 1:1 all the way to the end of chapter 12, whatever verse that is, Jesus is offering the millennial kingdom. But when you get to Matthew 13, verse 1, forward, He's now teaching about the gracious dispensation, the parentheses that's going to come. And according to the dispensationalists, the goal of God's doing all of this, all this time, the goal has been one thing. The kingdom of heaven on earth. The millennial kingdom. The Davidic kingdom. The thousand-year rule and reign. And so each of these tests, had the human race obeyed and fulfilled the test, God would have brought in the promised blessings. And you have to understand a dispensation that way. God says to the human race, here's a test. If you fulfill it, here's the blessing. If you don't, here's the curse, the judgment, and then He brings in another test. It's crucial to understanding the effects of dispensationalism on the gospel. Just hang on to that thought for a minute. But the goal all along has been the millennial kingdom. So when we come to this idea of the church and of grace, we are a parenthesis. In fact, one author says, he doesn't even like the term parenthesis. It's Lincoln. I can't remember his first name. He prefers the term intercalation, which is an insertion. It's where you've got something and you break it apart and insert something in the middle of it. He says, that's what the church is. God was going along with this plan to bring in the millennial kingdom, and He stops. And His prophetic eschatological time clock just stops at Matthew chapter 13. And then here's the church age. And God's got this 2,000-year, 3,000-year, whatever, time out, okay, until the rapture occurs. And then the clock starts again, and then God picks back up here where He left off here, and goes about bringing in the goal of the kingdom of heaven on earth. Any questions about that? I'm assuming most of you are familiar with it. Hey, Jason. It's Schofield, and you will find it in Pentecost, and it's pretty pervasive, at least as far as I know. In fact, turn, if you will, to Matthew 12. Because Pentecost takes it, takes Schofield's notes here. I wonder if I can get Matthew 12. Your mother and father are without, your mother and your brothers are out without. Who are my mothers and brothers? Whoever does the will of my Father in heaven is my brother and sister and mother. Matthew 13:1. On the same day, Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea. Both Schofield and Pentecost imply that this verse is to be taken more than just narrative, that Jesus went out of the house and sat by the sea. That the house is the house of Israel, and the sea is the sea of the Gentiles. I was trying to see if I can find it in Schofield's notes. You do. Where have you got, brother? I'll find the reference for you. And it's also in this, in J. Dwight Pentecost's Things to Come. But the idea is that there is that break in Matthew. And the reason for that is what takes place in Matthew chapter 13? About what? The kingdom. And what does Matthew 13 tell you about the kingdom? That it's the spreading of the gospel throughout the world, right? The good seed, the good ground, okay, the wheat and the tares, the casting of the net, all right? That has nothing to do with the millennium, and they know it. So they know Matthew 13 is not speaking of the millennial kingdom. So at that point, what they say is they say Jesus has switched his topics. And now the kingdom is the kingdom in a mystery form. That's why Jesus in Matthew 13 talks about the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven. To them, the kingdom of heaven has now entered into a mystery form, which is the church, the parenthesis. Up until that time, he is offering a literal millennial kingdom. And when he says the kingdom of heaven is at hand, he means the Davidic kingdom. From Matthew 13 forward, the kingdom now means kingdom in a mystery form. And is distinct from what they mean by kingdom in the first 12 chapters of Matthew. Blaine, go ahead. That seems to be a Scofield development. I only say that because I can't find it in Darby anywhere or the Brethren teaching. That's an argument from silence. I'm not saying that they didn't hold to it. I'm saying I've never been able to find them espousing that. So take the limits of that for what it is. Oh, yeah, there is no such thing as a kingdom people right now. Other than the kingdom in a mystery form. Yeah. The real kingdom is yet to come. The kingdom of God has not arrived. The kingdom of heaven has not arrived. Won't arrive until after the 7-year tribulation and Jesus Christ returns and sets up his throne in Jerusalem. Everything is made to fit with this idea. I've only got a limited amount of time. I'm going to move on, and because what I really want to get to is its applications and implications for church practice. So they have the definitions and outline of dispensations. They believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. Pentecost defines it this way. The literal method of interpretation is that method which gives to each word the same exact basic meaning it would have in normal, ordinary, customary usage, whether it's employed in writing, speaking, or thinking. What's wrong with that? Does the Bible always use words in a normal, ordinary, customary context, like day-to-day conversation? No. You've got, for example, apocalyptic images. You have poetry. You have metaphor, simile. You have hyperbole, exaggeration. All sorts of figures of speeches in the Bible in all kinds of contexts. The idea behind the literal interpretation is that a word always means the same thing, or is supposed to always mean the same thing. So Israel in Genesis and in Exodus means the same thing in Israel in Jeremiah 31:31. Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And dispensationalists insist you must interpret that passage, house of Israel, house of Judah, the same way you interpret Israel and Judah in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, Exodus, Deuteronomy. That this phrase must have the same exact basic meaning. Israel must be Israel. Hang on to that one. We'll come back. The church and Israel are completely separate, have nothing to do with each other. And God's goal in history is the manifestation of His glory on earth. For a doxological purpose. These last three... If you have Charles Ryrie's Dispensationalism Today, he says are the essentials of dispensational thought. How do you know if you're a dispensationalist? Well, if you believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible, that the church and Israel are completely separate, and that God's goal in history is His glory on earth, by which they mean the Davidic kingdom, millennial kingdom, then you are a dispensationalist. Those are the sine qua non, the essentials of dispensational thought. All right. What are the implications of all of this? Remember, we said that a dispensation is a test to which man always fails and God brings judgment. In dispensational thought, grace, the age of grace, the age of the gospel, is a dispensation. Now, it's a parenthetical dispensation. It's the odd man out. It's the red-headed stepchild of dispensations, if you will. But it is still a dispensation. That means grace, or the gospel, is a test. Now think about that for a second. If you believe that, how does that affect your presentation of the gospel? Well, you know they're going to fail at the end of the age. That's the next thing we're going to talk about here. But the gospel is a test. It's like the law at Mount Sinai. It's like the human government after Noah's flood. It's a test. So what does that do to your presentation of the gospel? Well, I think it would lead to this kind of a presentation. God has this plan. It's called the gospel. It's called grace. I'm going to tell you about it. Now, do you accept it or not? This is a test. I think it could, and not just the pastor, it might lead to that kind of a concept among those who have passed the test, period, whether pastors or not. But doesn't it make it very human response oriented? You know, we blame Arminianism for a lot of the human volitional element. But quite honestly, dispensationalism has encouraged that as well. Because dispensationalism presents the gospel as a test to which you are to either respond positively or negatively. Well, it's true, it's not going to bring in the millennial kingdom, which is God's main goal in history. But there is the distinction between heaven and hell and eternity to come. Schofield and Chafer and others, to my satisfaction, never addressed the issue as to whether this means that salvation is by a different test in other dispensations. They always denied that. Oh, no, salvation is always by grace. Schofield has a note in the book of Leviticus that says, well, yes, it's by grace, but the object of their faith is different under every dispensation. So the object of our faith in this dispensation is the cross of Christ. The object of the faith under the law is the sacrifices. Grace being a test also implies something else. And we didn't cover this earlier, so I'm going to give you the background so you'll understand where I'm coming from on this. Every dispensation in dispensational thought is an unconditional dispensation. It's an unconditional promise of blessing. The only difference is law. Law is very conditional from the very get-go. But the way dispensationalists look at each dispensation is that it's unconditional with the exception of that there are no conditions, with the exception of the reception of the test or the passing of the test. So that once that test is passed, God is now obligated, no matter what, to bring in the promised blessings. So let's apply that to the gospel. The gospel is a test. I bring it to you. You pass the test by accepting the gospel. God is now obligated, no matter what you do from that point forward, to save you. If you pass the test and live like the devil the rest of your life, God still has to save you. It is my opinion that the carnal Christian theory owes most of its of support, not to Arminianism, but to dispensationalism. A consistent Arminianism says somebody accepts Jesus Christ but then goes out and lives in sin. What happens? They lose their salvation. And it's always baffled me how Arminians, dispensational Arminians, can be one-point Calvinists so stubbornly. Where does that stubbornness on that one point of eternal security come from? It doesn't come from their Arminianism. It comes from the dispensationalism. Dispensationalists say Abraham passed the test. Therefore, God's promise of giving Abraham the land of Canaan and to his descendants forever must be unconditionally fulfilled regardless of what Israel has done in the past or does in the future. That's why the millennium is the time when the Jews all come back and rebuild the temple and reinitiate the sacrifices and on and on and on and on, and on down the line. God's got to do it because Abraham passed the test. So it doesn't matter if Israel's idolatrous or not. Well, that idea carries over into the dispensation of grace. You pass the test of the gospel, God's got to save you no matter what you do from that point forward. And that's where I believe the major support of the carnal Christian theory comes from. Second implication is that all of God's plans on earth end in failure. The gospel is going to end in failure. The millennium ends in failure. Jesus Christ personally reigns for 1,000 years. And there's this massive rebellion at the end. Every plan, every dispensation ends in failure. What's that going to do to your outlook on life in general? Or your outlook on God? When I was a strict adherent to dispensational thought, I believe in my own life, it produced a certain kind of pessimism. No sense polishing the brass on a sinking ship. This world is headed for apostasy. Things are only going to get worse. That's the kind of attitude that is spurred by dispensational thought. Now, I'm not a postmillennialist, but there is something attractive and I think biblical about the idea that Jesus Christ rules and reigns and His kingdom is forever. Even if we are killed all the day long as sheep for the slaughter, we are still more than conquerors. There is an optimism to Scripture that I believe dispensationalism undermines. Grace and law are total opposites. This has already been taught on prior in the week. You can figure out the results of that. let me give you a quote, though, from Chafer. Since law and grace are opposed to each other at every point, it is impossible for them to coexist, either as the ground of acceptance before God or as the rule of life. So law and grace cannot coexist in your life when you go to decide, you know, decisions, moral decisions of your life. If you're under grace, you're under grace. You have no law. Of necessity, therefore, the scriptures of the New Testament, which present the facts and scope of grace, both assume and directly teach that the law is done away. Consequently, law is not in force in the present age in any sense whatsoever. This present nullification of law applies not just to the legal code of Mosaic system, but to every possible application of the principle of law. Lewis Berry Chafer, in his book entitled Grace, published by Moody Press, 1947, page 215. Lewis Berry Chafer says that grace and law are so opposite that every concept of law is inapplicable to this age. You are under grace, you have no law at all. And you cannot make law and grace work together in any sense. Antinomianism, Sanctification by what? Following your own rules? Deciding life's issues on the basis of what? Man-made rules? Impulses of the Spirit? Anything but law. I remember, I think it was Larry that told me this one, about tithing, where someone's advice to you was give 9%, 11%, anything but 10%. Where'd you hear that? Charles Ryrie. Whatever you do, don't give 10, because 10 is law. Give whatever else you feel like, however else the Spirit leads, but don't do anything that sounds legal. Okay. Well, how are you as a Christian going to decide the issues of your life at that point? You're going to decide them on one of two bases. Either man-made law, yours or somebody else's, which comes nigh to legalism or Pharisaism, or the Spirit told me to do this, so I'm doing it. And dispensationalism can support either system. Fourth, the new covenant has nothing to do with the church. Jeremiah 31:31, I'm making a covenant, new covenant with who? House of Israel, house of Judah. Therefore, the new covenant really has nothing to do with you and me whatsoever. Charles Ryrie, The Basis of the Premillennial Faith, says this: the new covenant is made with the physical seed of Abraham according to the flesh, and with them alone. This is made clear for three reasons. The words of the establishment of the covenant in Jeremiah 31 make this clear: the house of Israel and the house of Judah. Its very name, New Covenant, makes it contrasted with the Old Covenant, or the Mosaic Covenant. Therefore, the New Covenant must be made with the same people as the Old Covenant, which is National Israel. Third, the perpetuity of the nation of Israel and her restoration to the land is vitally linked to the New Covenant. According to Charles Ryrie and Schofield and Schaefer, the new covenant's purpose is to guarantee that Israel will get back to the land in the millennium, and has nothing to do with you and me. One lady in our church, when I was going through this recently in Sunday school, very astutely said, "So what is it then that Jesus meant when he said, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood'?" 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6, Paul refers to himself as a minister of the new covenant. And Hebrews 8, Hebrews 9, I'll leave it to you to figure that one out. If we take away the idea that the church is under the new covenant, what does that do to your concept of the church? We're a parenthesis. We're not God's major view at all. We're not what God's plan, I hate to say it, but plan. We're not God's plan A. The church is not the fulfillment of God's plans on earth. Let me close with this statement, this application. How can you love something that is not God's primary plan? If one of the things that we see, one of the symptoms of ill health of the church, is a disregard for the church, can we really blame people for disregarding the church when the system of theology that interprets history for them tells them that the church is really just a parenthesis, that the church is not God's plan, that it's not the fulfillment of God's plan on earth, that God's fulfillment lies yet in a future physical kingdom of rigid legal enforcement? And that's what God has been working towards all along, and we're just some sort of insertion. One of the major symptoms of church ill health is that people have a disregard for the church. Well, why not, if this is what you've been taught? I'm going to leave you with just a couple of observations. First of all, when you look at the seven dispensational scheme of dispensationalism, you're going to see that each of those dispensations coincides either with a covenant-making event or a something consequent to a covenant. Adam in the Garden of Eden. Okay? Or right afterwards, the fall after the breaking of the covenant of works. The Noahic covenant corresponds with the human government dispensation. Okay? The promised dispensation coincides with the Abrahamic covenant. The law dispensation coincides with the Mosaic covenant. I suggest to you that dispensationalism is actually a form of covenant theology. That it is a new scheme for interpreting the covenants of history. But it interprets them not on the basis of God pursuing a plan of salvation for His people based on an eternal covenant of grace, but God pursuing a political entity on earth, a legal entity, if you will, geographic kingdom on earth, based on His desire to glorify Himself on earth. It is a covenant theology, and I think we need to see it that way. Furthermore, dispensationalism has become so dominant that most people who've been raised in it have a really hard time getting out. Mitchell Jones, in introducing me, observed that back in 1987, I think it was, Rhodes College in Memphis at the first Founders Conference that I went to, it might have been 88. What year did J.I. Packer speak on revival? Do you all remember? 88. So it's 88. The reason I was having so much trouble with Calvinism and struggling through it is that I didn't want to let go of my dispensationalism. Jim yesterday said, by the way, you guys stole all my best remarks. Fred, Jim, you just took them right out from under my feet. Said, you don't see how someone can be a Calvinist and not be covenantal. I agree. I also don't see how somebody can be dispensational and not be Arminian. Of necessity, they go hand in hand. And yet, because dispensational thought is so hard to leave, I mean, it's like leaving the mother church or something. It really is. It's hard. That I think we find in our time period, people who have become convinced of the doctrines of grace and have not fully let go of dispensationalism. In my book, New Covenant Theology is a very slight, but nonetheless a form of dispensationalism because it has a different ethic according to Old versus New Testament, different law. And I don't see any way around that conclusion. If I'm wrong, let me know. Maybe the optimist in me thinks that this is a transitional period. And if God is yet gracious to us, the resurgence of an understanding of His sovereignty may yet lead to a resurgence of the understanding of His eternal covenant as well. May He make it so. Any final questions or comments before we close? Not anything like it. The Achilles heel of dispensational thought is the fact that the new covenant has nothing to do with the church. That has never been successfully defended. There's never been any mutation or explanation to accomplish that. Ryrie explored the idea for a while that there were actually two new covenants. I think Walbert joined him with that. That there was a new covenant that applied to the millennium and a new covenant that applies to the church, but there are actually two separate new covenants. Well, there's no textual evidence for it whatsoever, so that argument fell apart. Historically, as they're working through this and, you know, journal responding to journal article, that sort of thing. So, consequently, this scheme has been jettisoned for the most part. You can see the beginnings of that even in the personal history of someone like John MacArthur, who started off pretty solidly dispensational, and now he's kind of moved a little bit, and he's become more Calvinistic, and that has affected some of his thought. Not a lot, but some. The current schemes are progressive dispensationalism. And even that has undergone change. And the latest books that I would recommend to your reading are ones by Craig Blazing and Daryl Bach on progressive dispensationalism. I think one of them is called Israel, the Church, and Dispensationalism. And then another one by the name of, author by the name of, I believe his first name is Kenneth, if I remember right, Kenneth Saucy. S-A-U-C-Y, has a book on progressive dispensationalism that's very good. Just come out, I think, in the last 4 years or so. Excellent, because their understanding is totally different. They still have the church as somewhat of a parenthesis. They still have the final fulfillment in Israel in the millennium. They're still premillennial in that sense. It's not as nationalistic. It's not as Jewish. There aren't seven dispensations. It basically comes down to like two. So there's a lot of alteration that's going on. Quite honestly, I interpret all of that as an attempt to hold on to dispensationalism when the roots have been knocked out from underneath of it. And they're adapting and they're changing and they're modifying because what they had doesn't work. And my personal perspective is this whole system will eventually be jettisoned. Walt Kaiser is working on what he thinks is a tertium quid called evangelicalism. And that is also some interesting reading as well. I can tell you what I was taught, but I may have to let others fill in the gaps. I was taught that those were to be seen as principles, not commandments. That's not law. These are principles. And so you take these principles, and then as the Spirit leads, you apply them to your life. But there is no such thing as law. My first semester, first year Bible college, had a systematic theology professor lecturing on antinomianism. And this is an older guy. So he'd been trained theologically back probably in the 20s, maybe the 30s. And he's going through the tenets of antinomianism, and he's writing them on the board. And I'm listening, and I'm taking notes, and I'm being a good attentive student. Turns and he says, "Are there any questions?" I raise my hand. Dummy. I raise my hand. And he says, "Yes." I said, "So that's what we are, right?" He dropped his chalk. Well, no, not exactly, you see. And I never did understand his explanation as to why we weren't antinomian. Made perfect sense to me. That's what I've been taught all my life. No, Paul's instructions are not commands. This is what I was taught. They are principles. And furthermore, as principles, you shouldn't try to apply them woodenly or strictly. The Spirit is going to lead you as to how you're going to put them into practice in your life. So kind of a watchman knee, sort of a normal Christian life, Spirit-led, always listen to the Spirit's impressions as He applies the Word to your life, that kind of thing.